Hey everybody, and welcome to another Turned Up interview. And as always, we are so appreciative of the artists to give up their time here to speak to us here on the show. And we have someone pretty special on the show tonight. This man's been involved in a lot of projects, a lot of artists that are probably pretty well known to you out there. I first played music that this man's associated with Johnny Master and Mama's Boys, Real New Orleans Swamp. He's also involved with a very talented young lady called Gallia Vault, involved in songwriting, involved in production. And it's a real pleasure to welcome to the show the one and only Mr. Dean Zuccarello. How are you, Dean?
Hello, Jerry. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time. This is a delightful experience.
Well, same here. Dean, tell me, I mean, you're involved in so many things, but how did it all start for you, Dean, as a young man? How did the bug and music, what brought you into it, or what were your influences?
Well, I started playing music in 79, and my whole life prior to that, I was just obsessed with music in general, and I was an avid listener. I grew up listening to some of the, you know, the 60s rock, 60s rhythm and blues, the balladeers that my parents used to listen to. Big fan of the British Invasion, Elton John and the Beatles and the Stones and everything that was going on. And finally, the time came. I was about 15 or 16 where my friends were playing in a band, or they started the band. One was a drummer, one was a guitar player, and they needed a bass player, and I had always wanted to play music, and the opportunity arose, and we went across town, bought a bass and an amplifier for $35. My mother had given me the money, and I showed up, and my friend showed me, I still remember the songs. It was 79, so it was The Ocean, My Sharona, and Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin. And those were the first three songs I learned. And then from that, I got involved in other styles of music and funk and reggae and jazz. So it goes back to about 79.
Yeah, so you kind of, once you got that bass and learned off the songs, you kind of knew then this is something you really wanted to do, Dean, did you?
Yeah, it was something that I always wanted to do. I just didn't have the opportunity, and it finally came about. And then I had other plans for school. I went to school, didn't really apply myself because I wasn't interested in that particular occupation. And I went back to, I started a band called Anastasia in 1984. We wrote a lot of songs and we toured a bit. We finally signed to an indie record label in about 1990, and we toured the East Coast a lot. We had some moderate success. I have a nice collection of songs that I co-wrote with the band. And then after that, I moved into the city and just wanted to play blues. So I joined a few blues bands. This was in Manhattan back in the day, and kind of excelled from there. I picked up a gig with Papa Chubby at some point. I did a tour with him in Europe. And then I played in Manhattan until about, when was it, 2004. And then I took a gig in Shanghai at a jazz club for 3 months. And from that, I got offered another gig in Zurich, Switzerland for 3 months. And then I stayed in Europe for 9 years. Until about 2013, I lived in Zurich and then near Milan in Italy, and then came back. I had no more apartment in New York, and I decided to give it a go down in New Orleans. And in 2014, I kind of landed here and met Johnny Mastro, started playing with him, and then met Cyril Neville, started playing with him, and just, you know, it's a very collective, communal kind of scene down here, so you get opportunities to play with a lot of people. And it's been wonderful.
You've really seen quite a bit of the world, Dean. I mean, listen to what you're saying there. You were in Europe for 9 years. You're in Zurich. You're in New Orleans. I mean, I have to ask the question, you know, has all of those experiences, living in different parts of the world, experiencing different cultures. Do you think has that enriched the creative process, the songwriting process, that you have a really large pool of memories and experiences to draw on when you're actually writing music?
Sure. I mean, lyrically, of course, you know, you're exposed to different languages and different idioms and different metaphors. So that's always helpful with the lyrical aspect of it. And I guess just unconsciously being around different cultures, different languages, kind of inspires a certain inflections in your playing, in your style. Yeah, it's been wonderful. I've had the opportunity to actually play on 6 continents. So been to Australia a couple of times. Down in South America, we did a little tour with Cyril. It was a blues cruise, so we made it to Curacao. I got to play there. And Europe a bunch of times, of course, and Africa. I went to Africa, South Africa, with Cyril Neville a couple of years ago. And it's wonderful. It's one of the advantages of being a musician is that we have the opportunity to travel.
And yeah, something that should... I mean, Dean, you know, the blues, right, there's a certain style to it. There's a certain way it's played. But would you say the fact that you've played music in so many different parts of the world, is the style of blues expressed a bit different in each country? And is it noticeable? I mean, British blues probably is played a lot different to say Louisiana blues. And would you have noticed that and you've stayed and lived in a lot of countries, that each country had its own blues identity or its own style of playing the blues?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's subtle. Don't forget, every country has a musical history, and you know, every musician in that country has been exposed to that musical history in some way, consciously or unconsciously. So that's inevitably going to feed your approach to any new style that you decide to take on. I think it's intangible, but it's certainly there. You know, the Brits do their thing with the blues. I mean, they completely turned it on its head in the 60s. I guess they had to. As Robert Plant put it, he said, we had no right trying to sound like, you know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. You know, we had to completely bastardize the blues, and they did it in a very unique way. I think that goes on in any country.
Would you say that, you know, yes, the blues, I suppose, look, its roots are in the States, but it has kind of, like most genres, it has universal roots. And would you also say that, you know, I kind of feel that the blues is, it's a statement of what's happening in society at a particular time, because originally when the blues were sang and songs were written, to be honest, it was, you know, coming from a people that were downtrodden, that really didn't have a lot of freedoms or liberty, and music was one of the few things that had to lift their spirits. Whereas maybe nowadays it could be linked to maybe social problems or different ideas, and maybe still can be linked with the past. But I still think the blues as a form of music, as a form of expression, still has as much relevance today as it maybe had 100 years ago, for maybe totally different reason. But you get that kind of fulfillment if you're singing the blues about something, that it still touches on what's happening in our everyday lives.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we can't relate to the blues the way the forefathers of the architects of the genre could relate. Obviously, they're coming from a very different place, and blues definitely from a place of suffering. But everybody suffers in their own way, emotionally, physically. Some a lot, some less, but I think blues kind of comes from that part of the human being. Even sonically and tonally, it has a very melancholic kind of feel to it. I think Yeah, I think it's relevant. It'll always be relevant. And the genre has kind of inculcated all other genres. I think good music is better if it has a blues bass to it. I think rock is better when it has a blues bass. I think jazz is better when there are blue notes in it. That's my opinion. I think it's more interesting and more expressive.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, the blues is, relevant and prevalent and ongoing.
Yeah, and Dean, as well as that, for me, like, of course, the music's important because music is vibration, and if you connect with it in a certain way or it's played a certain way, there's definitely a synergy between the listener and the music. But lyrics, I mean, when you write the lyrics to a song, I mean, does it a lot of times come from a real life encounter or experience, and then you turn that into a song? A lot of people will tell you that that happens. Some maybe say that it's the total creative process, but a lot of people will have something that happened in their lives or something they come across, and then they create that in a lyric and then put music to it. How would you do that in your process? Would it be a bit of both?
Yeah, I think it's either a conscious effort to write about something or an unconscious effort. There's, stuff seeps through in a symbolic way, whether you're aware of it or not. And some writers are very, very conscious of it. A guy like John Lennon ultimately was writing about himself, and he admitted to that pretty often. If I write a lyric, it's usually about something I can relate to or something I've experienced. It's easier that way, and I think it's more candid.
It probably connects a bit more, Dean, because a lot of us have had similar experiences in life, maybe not exactly the same, but things that have happened to us during our lives. And it does strike a chord if you hear someone sing about something that maybe resonates with your own personal life experience. It has to. And I think that's, no matter what it is, whether it's poetry, music, whatever it may be, if you can touch on a subject that maybe a lot of people have had or been through, it makes it more personal to them, so they're going to identify a bit more with the music, or particularly the lyrics, as they say, for me, are a big thing. But going then, maybe say, from the technical side of things, Dean, you were saying you started in 79, and, in those days, it was very much get signed to the record company, get the tour, support a major band, and, hopefully get decent album sales. That has all changed dramatically, in that probably there's not the same level of dependency on the record companies to get this contract. There's not obviously financially the same income from something like that. But having been in the business this long, what's your view as a musician now? Do you feel there's more freedom as a musician now to get your music out there, to play? Is it better or worse, or what would your own views be on it at this stage?
Well, when we started back in the day with the band Anastasia, which ultimately changed to Major Domo, we were seeking a record deal because that was really the only way. I guess you could put a band together and go on the road and, just travel around the country and try to book gigs, but that information wasn't out there. It wasn't as available as it is now through the internet. So, you wanted a record deal, and we pursued it for a while. And ultimately, we found a label that was interested in us around 1990. It was an indie, but they invested some money in us, and it worked out pretty well. Nowadays, I don't know. There's much more independence, but with that independence comes a lot more competition because now everybody has access to this information. If you want to book a tour in Europe, you can find out all the clubs. You can find out the agencies that do it. They're not going to accept everybody who applies, of course. But I like to see it in a positive way, that there is a lot more freedom. And I think the record companies, perhaps greed got to them. They were taking too much from the artists. And now there's a little bit of an emancipation. And now what they do is they sit back and they handpick who they want, which acts have achieved some success. They won't really sign anyone now unless you have a touring base and you know, you've sold a certain amount of records. So yeah, I think it's a good thing what happened with the internet, and in some ways it's frustrating to the songwriter because of the royalty issues that go on now with things like Spotify. If I could tell you, you know, the last record I produced, which was Mississippi Blend by Gallia Volt, and I co-wrote some songs with her on it. I mean, the streaming, the number of streams was incredible. She did hit the charts. She hit number 3 on Billboard, which was really, really nice to see. But the amount of streaming compared to the amount of sales is just, it's ridiculous. So I think that's worked against the artist in modern times, and most people would agree with that.
Yeah, I suppose the plus side to it is, yes, you're right, and I have heard this spoken about so many times, but I suppose the plus side is raising the profile, that if you have quality and if you get your music out and you get them on those platforms, then when you come to play or gig in an area, you're actually a known entity, so the chances are you're going to pull a fairly decent crowd as well, which unfortunately at the minute it seems to be that the money for the artists is in the live performances. Like, I seen it happen where there was a band came to Dublin 2 years ago, never played Ireland before, and there was a venue, it was a 400 capacity venue, never been there before, they sold it out, and it was simply because their social media presence was well known. So I think the negative side is, you're right, the money that the artist gets from a man like that is a pittance. But the plus side is, I think, that there's a pathway to get your music out there, to get your identity out there, that you can connect with your potential audience, and hopefully that in the long run, that leads to greater things. But it is, I suppose, we can't turn the clock back. It is what it is. And as someone else said, you have to adapt to whatever conditions are there and make the most of it.
Correct. I agree with that. I agree. You have to adapt to the, to technology. And this is where we're at. The advantage is now that you can, you know, back in the day, record companies put bands on the road and lost money because of that, but they wanted to sell records, and hopefully, you know, a spike in sales will offset the touring expenses. In some cases it did, but now bands can make money on the road, and I think record companies also want to tap into that too now, because record sales aren't like what they used to be. So you have to be careful of that as an artist as well.
Yeah, and probably to a degree, even merchandise, whether it's T-shirts, CDs, things like that. There's a personal touch that if you're playing somewhere and you're chatting to the fans afterwards, you will sell merchandise, because even if people have it on Spotify, if they meet the artist and they can buy a CD or a short, there's a personal connection, maybe get it signed, whatever. So there is that element to it that actually is thriving pretty well. I suppose recording stuff, Dean, you know, years ago, like as we spoke earlier, you know, the recording studio time was very expensive. And unless you had a major record company, you know, to really take up the costs, it was difficult. Now, there's way, sometimes people can record stuff on their own homes, or the technology is there to create an audio quality that years ago would have cost tens of thousands, that now can be done for a relatively inexpensive amount of money. So I suppose there is that part to it too, that if you do want to record something, it doesn't have to be the huge expense it might have been in the past.
Correct, yes. And then the promotion of the record too. You know, that is an expense, and being involved with a couple of productions with Roof Records over in Germany, you know, I saw more of how not only important it is to promote the record, have a PR crew and a radio promoter and all that, but it's costly. And I think, you know, artists can do that on their own, but it's going to take money. But it's completely important to do, because to produce a record, and to think it's just going to sell on its own is a mistake. It has to be promoted. And back to the idea of merchandising, you know, that's the lifeline and the bloodline of the tour. You know, that's where you pay for all your expenses, your internal expenses, transportation, gas, driver, you know, merch guy, all that. So you do need to go on the road with a fair amount of merch, CDs, of course. You have T-shirts, and that's your profit, and it really keeps the tour going. It's essential.
It's essential. It's an essential part of it. Going back to the people you're associated with, we mentioned there just earlier in the interview about Gallia Vault. How did you meet? How did that associate? Like you have co-written songs on the album, and it's done extremely well. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that association, or how it came about, or even what's planned at the moment.
Regarding Gallia Vault, we met. She's from Belgium, and she came to the United States in 2014, I believe, and did a tour of all the musical meccas of the States, in Chicago and St. Louis and New Orleans and places in Mississippi, Memphis. And she ended up in New Orleans at one point. I think we met briefly. And then I was on tour later that year, that springtime, in Belgium. And with Johnny Mastro, I was playing with. And she was there. She had just come back from the United States. So she came after the show. She came up and introduced herself. I remembered her. And then we kind of kept in touch throughout the summer, and because Johnny was coming back in September, and she helped organize a show in her town, which was Brussels, and we met there. And then she ultimately said, "I want to do a recording with using the Mama's Boys as the backing band." So we went out to I forgot where we did it, somewhere outside of New Orleans, and we recorded three of her songs. And I realized then how talented she was as a writer. We were kind of taken back by it. And I thought, I mean, I know a record company that would love this artist and these songs, you know, and that was Roof Records and Thomas Roof. So I sent it off to Roof Records. It was right before Christmas. And I had kind of left it alone for a couple of weeks. And in the interim, there was a DJ, Dr. Boogie, who knew Gallia and saw her grow as an artist. And he just, on his own contacted Roof Records and said, "You should really check out this girl." And Thomas Roof did, and ultimately wanted to sign her and wanted to have the Mama's Boys as the backing band, because he thought it was he really loved the demo. And in fact, he loved it so much, he was even thinking of using the demo as part of the record, but we thought we could sonically do a better record. So I talked to Thomas about it, and the idea of me producing the record with Gallia, of course, and he was okay with that. He liked it because I said, "If you like the demo, it's going to be a lot better. It's going to be that plus more." And he said, "Okay." So we did the record, and then she was off. And we did a couple of tours with the Mama's Boys in Europe. And then she did her second record in Mississippi with Mississippi's finest. We had, who was on that record? Watermelon Slim. We had Cody Dickinson, Lightning Malcolm, I can't think of the other drummer. We did the record, and we produced it at Zebra Ranch, which is the old studio that Jim Dickinson owned, and now his sons, Luther and Cody, own it. We did it there. It was kind of a legendary place, and the record did quite well. So Gallia's on her own now. She did the one-woman band record last year. It was released this year, and that was kind of spawned from the reality of the pandemic, because the tours we had set up in Europe last winter were all being canceled, or because of the occupancy issues at the venues, the budgets were much lower. So she decided to do the shows herself. So she did this record, and Thomas Roof loved it and put it out, which was released in February. And, you know, flatteringly, it just hit the Billboard Blues charts yesterday at number 7. And I feel honored to be part of the record. I co-wrote one of the songs, the opening song, Last Minute Packer. And I did two bass tracks on the record. She recorded everything live, playing drums with her feet, guitar, and singing simultaneously. But she added bass on two tracks, and we did that over the internet, which was funny. She was up in Memphis at, I forgot the name of the studio, but we did that over the internet, and yeah, so that's what's going on. That's the story of Galia Vault and how I met her.
That's really beautiful, and I mean, it shows that the connection between like-minded people and what music can do, the way it can bring people together and create some very special moments. And I presume, you know, as we exit the restrictions of the pandemic and live music comes back, could you see the point, Dean, where yourself, the Johnny Mastro Band and Galia maybe go out on the road and tour when you're able to do so?
Yeah, I think as for now, I know Galia has this record that she's going to tend to and promote for the rest of the year. I know she has other plans down the road for a record in another big city. And Johnny, I think, is working on some tours coming up, perhaps in September, when, you know, everybody's waiting on what's going on in Europe right now. And I think me as well, we have a project here that I started up with Johnny Sansone from New Orleans, harp player, and Johnny Bergen, who's from Chicago. He's a Delmark Records artist. I met him down here. And I've been using him for this gig I curate out in the Bywater. And it so happened that Sansone knew Bergen already. So we decided, you know, to put a band together and maybe go to Europe, call it Sansone, Bergen, and Zucchero. Right now that's in the works. So that's going to be the priority this summer, hopefully in August. If things open up, we have an agent who's interested and is pushing the music around and the project. So that's probably going to be the next focus for me in terms of touring.
Well, Dean, it sounds like, you know, you've certainly packed an awful lot into your life so far. And even in the year of the pandemic, you've been a very busy man. And it sounds like the musical world of Dean Zuccarello is going to get busier by the moment. It's certainly been a great pleasure for me to speak with you here in the Torned Up interview. I love what you do musically. I didn't realise until recently your connection with Galia. I'm certainly a fan, and certainly, you know, with Johnny Master and Mama's Boys, really love that sound. And I wish every success. We will be playing tracks from Johnny Mastro and, of course, Galia in the not-too-distant future. I normally ask the artists for their choices, but just this time we're going to pick something out. It might be played a little sooner before the interview's broadcast, just the fact that there's new music out. But we will keep everybody informed of what you're doing, when the music's out, and when you can get it. And Dean, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you here on the show. Thank you so much for coming on the guest on this Torn It Up interview. We really appreciate it here at Radio Home Rock.
Thank you, Jerry. I really appreciate your time as well. It's very kind of you, and I love your love for music and your passion for it. And that's gentlemen like you help us out a lot in this world, and they keep it going. So thanks for that as well.
It's really my pleasure, because music means so much to me. It's my passion. It's my oxygen. I really couldn't survive without it. So meeting people like you and discussing all of this, it just means the world to me. And I'm privileged to be in this position. So thank you so much, Dean.
Okay. Take care. We'll chat again. Maybe I'll meet you in Europe this summer.
Absolutely. Take care, Dean.
Bye-bye.